Welcome to the podcast for Boomer Women, where we are embracing the journey. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. Today is the first time I've had two guests in a conversation. They are credentialed guests, though, so it's a really thought-provoking hour. Erin is a certified financial planner, and Laura is a professor of psychology, the director of aging studies program at California State U Fullerton, and a certified professional gerontologist. They combine talents to answer the question, what if there was a way to help everyone design their dream retirement before they even stepped into the office of a financial planner? I hope you appreciate the segment where they discuss the uniqueness of boomer women. Tailor-made for us, it seems to me. Listen now to my conversation with Erin Kirsch and Laura Zettel Watson. This is the first time I've had two guests on one conversation, and I'm quite excited. And these two come with credentials. Erin is a certified financial planner, and Laura is a professor. Ooh, I got to get my mouth around this. Laura is a professor of psychology, the directing of a. My goodness. Some things get edited, and some things just get left in to make Agnes look like the fool she is.
I love it.
Laura is a professor of psychology, the director of the Aging Studies Program at California State U Fullerton, and a certified professional gerontologist. The question that prompted their partnership was, what if there was a way to help everyone design their dream retirement before they even stepped into the office of a financial planner? The result is the Rewarding Retirement Workbook, Six Essentials Beyond Your Nest Egg. I appreciate the two disciplines collaborating, and I'm looking forward to our chat. Erin Kirsch, Laura Zettel Watson, welcome to the podcast for Boomer Women, where we are embracing the journey.
Thank you.
So good to be here.
I don't know why I always do that little fist pump when I say that we're embracing the journey.
I
dear, if we were on video, it might matter. Now,
like
I don't usually start by reading a profile verbatim, but I think it really gets to the point. And I quote, while most retirement books focus on what to do in retirement, we offer insight on how to have an amazing retirement and explain why a plan based on your values and goals will help you achieve your ideal life. We highlight research findings from positive psychologists and happiness experts, and then translate that research into thought exercises that help you tap into your personalized goals and values. Our evidence-based approach helps you conquer one component at a time to construct your ideal and personally tailored retirement plan. At the end of this book, you will put it all together, creating a comprehensive strategy for making your retirement life the best it can be. End quote. Now, Erin, you got the ball rolling by ruminating about your clients having the dream retirement formulated before they come to see you. So, sorry, I'm going to start with Laura. Laura, you, perhaps the collective you, mentioned that research shows that 50% of happiness is predetermined by genes and only 8 to 15% comes from circumstances like income. Now, a recent guest shared that optimistic people have about 7 years more than pessimistic people. And at this age, 7 years is a long time. Can you speak to that, please? And Aaron, feel free to jump in whenever you want.
Sure. Yeah, no, in psychology and in positive psychology in particular, there's definitely a desire to kind of figure out if we can put our finger on what the building blocks of happiness and life satisfaction and quality of life, where does that come from? And psychologists, from the beginning of the field, have been interested in how much is something nature or nurture. Nature being you're born with it. It's built into your DNA. Nurture is, your environment is shaping you, how you're raised shapes you. And so there are a lot of studies done with twins. If we've got identical versus fraternal twins that share, 100% versus only 50% of their genes, we can get an idea of how similar or different they are. And that gives us an idea. Adoption studies are another way that we can look at the contribution of genes versus environment. So when we find that certain aspects that we think don't sound genetic at all, like optimism, that's really quite fascinating that it does appear that they have some genetic component. So, as your previous guest stated, when we do discover a high level in what we call heritability in certain traits like that, it really kind of sets us to thinking, all right, well, if that's what is inherited in our genes, where does the rest of it come from? And I think that's what we were interested in, really, kind of with this book, drilling down into. We can't change your genetic makeup, but what we can do is take a look at that remaining percentage, the piece that either is coming from choices that we make, lifestyle behaviors, those kinds of things that we do have control over. And so that's what most of this book is about, is really figuring out what those elements are. So we break those six elements down and then talking about where the control comes in. Where do we have the ability? Because we really strongly believe that your listeners are in control, that, they're driving the bus. We are driving our own bus here. And so we get to make these decisions and decide where we want to make some changes and what we want to do.
Okay, well, that's an interesting segue because maybe it was my interpretation. At the risk of sounding argumentative, sorry, I keep on looking at my notes because I am quoting
Sure.
part of what you've done. After the 40% and the 8 to 15%, you asked what makes up that crucial 40% that people actually have control over. Now, I want you to answer that question, but Aaron, I want you to tell me that the 8 to 15% income part, I do have some control over, at least, me and my financial advisor have some control over.
You do have some control over that, certainly, yes. And how you allocate your investments and how you plan and how you take income from a tax standpoint and plan out your life, that's very important. But there's another interesting study that found that up to a certain point, once your basic needs are met, happiness doesn't dramatically change based on how much money you have. So it's really important to have your not to worry about food. It's really important not to worry about how you're going to pay rent or a mortgage, right? But billionaires aren't necessarily happier than millionaires.
Okay. One thing that I've remembered, like literally for decades, is a workshop I went to many years ago. I had a career in elder care, and it was re residential elder care. And what they were trying to do was get an idea about probably retirement happiness. I'm not quite sure. And so they interviewed, or part, it was a, actually in-person conference kind of thing. They had so many older people, I'm using air quotes there, mention that the number one most important thing to their retirement, and as I'm saying this, I'm thinking maybe it's just retirement success as opposed to retirement happiness, but the number one factor was having money.
That's interesting. I think, with my clients, running out of money is certainly a concern. And the more money you have, the less concerned you are, obviously, right? But I feel that most people have this anxiety mostly coming up to retirement. But once they're in retirement, as long as their needs are met, they're okay. And as long as they've done the planning, and of course, this is coming from a planner, a financial planner. But doing the planning is really important. It's not just making sure there's money, but making sure that your family's protected. You look at insurance, ways to protect you and your family. You want to make sure that your estate plan is up to date so that your kids or your other family members or the charities that you care about are going to get your inheritance and it's not going to be tied up in courts or probate or, stolen from someone who shouldn't be getting it, right? So that's important. The estate planning, the protection, the income planning, the tax planning, these are all really important things. So if you're just saving money and that's all you're looking about, that could be a problem. But if you're doing the comprehensive financial planning and looking at all aspects, then I think there's a certain peace of mind that people can have knowing that everything is covered.
So I've spent like 30 years worrying about how much. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, now I tend to write my notes based on your talking points, and I chuckled when I read that having a purpose in life can add up to 7 extra years of life expectancy. Now, can either of you suggest that if I'm happy, and have a purpose, I might get 14 more years.
was just gonna say that. It's like, I don't know
And
that it's additive.
oh dear, okay, because
I don't know that it's.
I was going to keep you on afterwards and get your
But you can
signatures on a
try.
piece of paper.
You can try. And I'll add that we see the exact same thing with strong social relationships is about 7 years. So we might be able to get you to 21 if we play these cards right.
Well, you know,
I
I
do
d
think, yep,
go
sorry,
ahead.
go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, I do think that they tend to be often wrapped up in the same person, right? The individual who's an optimist tends to attract the social relationships, and those pieces together probably form that happiness and life satisfaction. So I think we might be tapping into the same 7 years every time, but you know, like you said, 7 years is 7 years.
Well, if you want to put me in your Rolodex, I'm just aged myself there, dated myself, is I have this saying that I'm going to live forever, and so far so good. So before you two retire, you can come back and check and see how many of those 7 years I've managed to accumulate
I
successively.
love it.
Okay, now I don't usually just take talking points off of the profile, but I really liked some of yours. So I'm not even sure I'm going to say this right. What are hedonic and eudaimonic happinesses? What are they? What is it? I don't mind who answers because you both know who knows what.
All right, well, maybe I'll start, but I'll let Laura dive more deeply into the details. Hedonic happiness is pleasure, and it comes from, you know, we know the word hedonism, right? That's immediate pleasurable activities. And then there's eudaimonic happiness, which is the satisfaction you get from achieving something. It's achieving long-term goals. And the interesting thing is that eudaimonic and hedonic goals are often in conflict with one another. And Laura gives some great examples about that.
Yeah, and I always like the ones about, you know, right now I'm exhausted and want to take a nap and, you know, at the end of the day, just go home, curl up on the couch with a good book and just veg out. But really, what I should be doing for my long-term health is hitting the gym and shopping for healthy food and cooking a healthy meal. And, you know, the hedonic me who wants to pick up fast food and sit on my couch for the rest of the evening or order in. Right, that's my immediate pleasure. That is what will make me happy now. It's what will bring me joy tonight. On the flip side, I also have to be thinking about, well, where do I want to be health-wise in 10, 20, 30 years? Do I want to be able to get up off that couch and move around and do the things that are interesting to me? And if I always err on the side of my hedonic pleasures and, you know, have pizza and watch movies every night, I'm probably not setting myself up for the best success in terms of my long-term goals. So I think the goal here is the balance between the two. We have to make sure we're always striving for that eudaimonic happiness, the long-term goal pursuit, that self-actualization and realization of those goals. In the meantime, though, if we only focus on that, then there's not a lot of joy in our everyday life. So we've got to find ways to, you know, have the, I could be on a diet, but every once in a while, I gotta have that birthday cake or that glass of wine with friends. Something that's not going to make me feel like I am forbidding myself from any joy in the daily life. So it's finding, it's striking that balance in order to find well-being.
When people talk to, when I talk to retirees, shall we say, for lack of a better word, that retirement word is just always hits air quotes. They often say that the nice part about this time of life is being able to spend time with their grandchildren, to be able to get involved with volunteer and philanthropic possibilities. Where does that sort of happiness, where it's not a person, well, it's personal insofar, but you're giving out the energy and the care and the habit, whatever, where does that fall?
That's the blessing of retirement, is to be able to move from the things you have to do, which is maybe raising family, having a career, all these responsibilities that you have, to now getting to do the things you want to do. And if that's spending time with family and grandchildren and volunteering, that's great. But the other thing is, there's plenty of research that shows that giving, doing things for others, is a lot more rewarding than just doing things for yourself. And if you talk to most people, most people who donate money will get more pleasure out of donating money than the recipients who are receiving the money. So there's plenty of research on that. Giving and being selfless is really an important part of happiness.
Okay. Now, the study that you cited, I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head, found that relationships matter more than money for happiness. Now, how does this change how people approach retirement planning?
That's a great question. I have really focused a lot in my career on social support, social networks, relationships throughout life, and in particular in the years after the age of 65, which often coincides around with the retirement period. And I think it's one of those things, just like Aaron had said earlier, about money is important to the point that your basic needs are met. And we can go back all the way to, we've talked about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where it's like first you have to be safe. And then, from the evolutionary theory, if you're being chased and about to be eaten, it doesn't matter if you have something to eat. You first need to be safe. Then you need to have food and shelter and the basics. But as we, as humans in particular, have kind of reached more self-actualization, we get to this stage of belongingness. And that's where once our basic needs are met, we need more to feel fulfilled. Health is going to be a big piece of that. I think people don't think about health until they don't have it, or until they start to feel like they're losing it. So health is certainly another one of those pieces that of the puzzle that we need to make sure we are taking care of. But relationships come in right next to that. And we absolutely see, I mentioned a minute ago about that being another thing that can add years to our life expectancy, feeling like we've got high quality relationships. In terms of a planning perspective, I think for the majority of us as social creatures, planning for our future involves other folks, whether it's a spouse or partner, that's an obvious one, but a lot of others are going to be thinking about children, grandchildren, sometimes siblings. I mean, my sister and I joke regularly. We're like, okay, when we end up, we want to have that sort of golden girls lifestyle. I think about it every time I'm on a beach somewhere. How much fun will this be with my sister someday? But those are things that if I'm thinking about only myself, I'm not considering that piece of the future that is very central to future goals, which are the human parts of, where I want to be is not even as important as who I want to be there with.
Okay.
Yeah, Agnes, if we think about humans, we're a hyper-social species. And if you just think of it from an evolutionary standpoint, we're not the strongest animal out there. We're not the fastest animal out there. We don't have sharp teeth, right? But we've survived as a species for all this time and got to the top of the food chain by being cooperative and highly social. And so that is hardwired into who we are. And so relationships are so vital to our survival and our happiness. If 100,000 years ago you left the tribe and you were out on your own, that was a death sentence, right? So we need other people to be happy. We need to give to other people to be happy. We need to have these relationships. It's vital to our survival, but it's vital to our well-being.
This is really interesting. And having two of you on at the same time is really interesting because when I put that question into my notes, I was thinking, this one's for Aaron. But then I also realized now that what I should have said is how this changes how people approach financial. Let's just change it into a question. Does it change how people approach financial planning as opposed to retirement planning?
Oh, absolutely. Almost everyone I work with, whether they have kids or they have nieces and nephews, they're always talking about taking care of their family. And when they're doing estate planning, is I want to make sure my kids are doing well. I want to make sure my grandkids are going to college. I was just speaking with someone the other day whose sister passed away. She did not have children, but her estate plan is leaving money to a dozen nieces and nephews. So this is really important. Family is super important, whether you have immediate family or or extended family, find it does play into things. And there are parents out there with kids who have special needs, and their number one concern is, what's going to happen to my kids when I'm gone? How do I take care of them? How do I protect them? And the money part is vital to all that. Money is the tool to get what you want out of life, and it's the tool to help those who you care about. It's not the end all be all, but it is a great tool.
Interestingly, I do have a friend who is a single woman, no children, and she's constantly making arrangements for the nieces and nephews. She's still young and busy and vital and all that sort of stuff, but it's, as you say that, it's relationships, eh? That's so important. Now, you say people should focus on activities rather than goals. I found that interesting. I don't know who's going to jump in on any of these now.
Well, maybe I'll start
Go
that.
for
Maybe I'll start that
it.
and have Laura finish it. We can have goals, but when we're boomers, you could have a goal to race in the Tour de France or run an Ironman or do an Ironman race, or you can have all these goals. Are you going to accomplish them? Well, probably not. But keeping busy is really important. Having something to do is really important. There's a lot of people who retire and they don't have a purpose and they don't have activities to do. And it's really hard to move from a life where you're very busy and you have a career and you have other people that depend on you to doing something completely different. And finding that purpose and having activities that support that purpose is really vital to having a rewarding life in retirement.
Yeah, and I think we stumbled across a really interesting study when we were researching this idea that you can have these goals, and oftentimes announcing them, making them public, telling them to other people actually reduces your chance of achieving it. Which, and I'll say as a psychologist for decades, that was really surprising to me because I was always, it's accountability. If I share, I want to exercise more, and I tell that to Aaron. He says, great. Well, I've said it out loud that actually what the study showed is it tricked my brain into thinking, oh, I've already done it then somehow. So instead, focusing on the activities related to that, actually going out and exercising, actually, or maybe it's taking my bike around the block every night or taking my dog for an extra long walk every morning, creating activities that will ultimately chip away at the goal gets me closer to the goal than just having a dream and a goal. So it's really this, we don't want to put the cart before the horse. We want to jump in and start doing the things that get us to the goals rather than focusing on the goal itself, per se.
Is that age related? Because this is exactly where I was going to go next in my notes, because jeepers, I don't know, 20 years ago now, I guess, I just made the decision that I needed to make a life change. My mom needed help. And so I told everybody, I'm going to move to that town. I'm going to build or buy a big house so that I can take care of my mom. She was dementing. And I'm going to open a B&B. And I tell you, the pressure for me of having put that out into the world. I sold my house. I gave up my career. I moved to that town. I bought a big house. My mother moved in and I opened a B&B. So I was really surprised when you said that putting it out into the world doesn't necessarily, although jeepers, it's like splitting hairs sometimes, like just that
Right.
whole activities to the goal. So.
And I think it sometimes depends on who your accountability coach is. Are you just putting that out in the world, just saying it to everyone? Or are you actually telling that to someone who you know and trust and respect, who expects from you the best and expects from you to actually live through and goes through those things, right? Who's actually a real accountability coach, a real accountability partner, rather than just someone you meet at a coffee shop.
Okay, I will admit that when I left the company I was working for, I had a management position, and there was a sort of a company-wide thing to, as a gift, like a collection for a gift, and they actually bought me a massive, great gift card for, I think it was like Bed Bath and Beyond or something. So it was like really pushing me towards, okay, you're gonna open a B&B, you'll need all this other stuff. So yeah, oh, now you've really got me questioning my own things. Okay, so you haven't seen my notes, but you're just moving on perfectly because accountability partners. I love accountability partners. Now, you say that 70% of people who send weekly updates to an accountability partner achieve their goals versus only 30% who don't. Now, jeepers. Almost 15 years ago, I was taking a course online and I was assigned an accountability partner. I'm going to repeat, 15 years ago. To this day, she lives in California. She is one of my dearest friends. The whole business thing is long done, and we talk to each other on Zoom every Sunday night. I do have an accountability partner. I'm in Canada. She's a Canadian woman living the dream down in the Dominican Republic. She's my accountability partner. We talk every second week. So, yeah, talk about accountability. And if someone's left their 9 to 5 and they're retired, I'm sorry, you're going to get air quotes every time I use that word. How do they go about finding an accountability partner?
I think to me, an accountability partner is what you make of it or what you want it to be. There are formal coaches out there you can pay to be your, you can hire someone to be your accountability partner. But I think like you, it can be more of a a natural formation. You found somebody who is just kind of a kindred spirit who you feel like you're on the same wavelength with, and you just decide this is somebody who, as Aaron mentioned, I trust, I respect, their opinion matters to me. That is an excellent person to create as your accountability partner. We have to be careful, though, to not have it be somebody that is lax with us in the sense, like I would say my husband, for example, would be a terrible accountability partner because in our relationship, his job is to keep me accountable, but it's also to comfort me when I'm upset. And so, if I have failed to reach a goal and I'm upset about it, that puts him in a position of does he pressure me to get back on it, get back on the horse and do that goal? Or does he try to make me feel better because I'm upset? You need an accountability partner that's not going to be put in the middle like that, who's not also responsible for your feelings. And not th I, that came out wrong. Don't let my husband listen to that part. I don't believe he's responsible for my feelings, but you know what I mean? Who's offering that kind of support to you? Someone who's your emotional supporter maybe is not the best accountability partner because you need somebody who can just be one role and do that well. Or if they've got a flip-flop between things, they're going to let you off the hook.
Agnes, how many times with your accountability partners have you thought to yourself, well, I have to do this or I'm going to let them down, and I don't want them to be disappointed with me.
Well, my first one was my real strict accountability partner because we were both on a mission. And I'll be honest with you, she's quite a bit younger than me. And early on, she challenged me on something. And I remember getting really PO'd and going, excuse me. And then after the call, which I maintained my cool, I thought, get off your high horse. And this is the one that 15 years later, now we're very dear friends. So, yeah, no, I get it. Now, you may have already answered this, but I'm going to ask it anyways. Because we've talked social relationships, does the accountability partner qualify? Because you're communicating, you're doing stuff with them once a week, you said, checking in. There's got to be a little bit of idle chatter around the accountability part.
Well, relationships are really important, whether they're family, whether they're friends, whether you are a mentor to someone younger. Having social relationships is just so vital, and it doesn't matter with whom it is. And we talk in the book a little bit about reestablishing maybe connections with past friends or trying to improve relationships with siblings who are probably going to still be around when parents are gone and when children have moved out. We talk about reestablishing old friendships. We talk about creating new friendships. So who you have the relationship with isn't important. I think the quality of the relationship is important. And even quantity is not. If you have 500 acquaintances, that's probably not as good as having 5 or 10 quality friendships, deep friendships with others.
Yeah, and I think the real important piece is we get different functions of relationship from different types of people. So, again, I can talk about this for hours. So, if you ever want to do a side chat, we've got friends in our lives who serve a role of companionship, and they may be people we hang out with, but we never really get closer to on an emotional level. They're still important. We've got people who are those true emotional shoulder to cry on. True confidants, critical. We've also got people who are what we call instrumental or tangible supporters. These are people who provide instrumental or tangible help and support, somebody who's going to mow your lawn if you're laid up, or somebody who can give you rides places or loan you $500, right? But they may not, again, be those emotional close people. And then you've got people you go to for advice and information. They perform a role. And so the trick is to not, you don't need all of this wrapped up in one person. Sometimes a true, really close best friend or partner can be that one, everything wrapped up in one. But most of us have perfectly successful social networks by having multiple people that we get a little piece of these from each person.
Okay. Can I ask a question that sounds, Aaron, like I'm criticizing you, and I am not doing that in the least. I think I came into the conversation. You're a financial planner. You are really up on the other stuff. Is that who you are, or is this a result of your collaboration with Laura?
That's a good
A bit
question,
of both.
Agnes. I think it's part of it's part of who I am. I've always been interested in learning, and I'm always trying to be better at what I do. And I started many, many years ago, started getting interested in something called behavioral finance. When you think about economics, economists have always thought of humans as rational people. And it turns out when it comes to money, we are not rational. And there are two psychologists, Amos Tversky and Danny Kahneman, who won a Nobel Prize in economics for figuring this out. So they found out that humans are not rational with money. They did a bunch of experiments back in, I think, the 70s and 80s. Is that right, Laura?
Sounds about right.
And so they're Nobel Prize winners and economists as psychologists figuring out this kind of thing. So being able to understand how people relate to money and how they deal with money on a psychological level, not on a rational level, because we're not rational as human beings, especially when it comes to money, was something that got me very interested in this. And then just this whole psychology of retirement. And when people come to me and they want to start planning, most people are planning for retirement. And the first question is very easy. When do you want to retire? And almost everyone has an answer for that. They have a number, they have an age. And the second question I typically ask is, what are you going to do in retirement? And that's really important because we need to know what it's going to cost and how do we plan for that? And what do you think most people answer?
You tell me.
Yeah, most
They
people
don't
are
know.
saying, most people say, I don't know, or I haven't thought about it,
Okay.
or there's just a blank stare. So I thought, well, what if that, and that's what led me to this idea of creating this book so that people could figure this out. And I've always been a collaborative type of person. Before I was a financial planner, I was an aspiring musician. And then I spent 8 years in the movie business, both very collaborative types of art forms. And I got to a place where I got stuck and I realized I need to collaborate. I'm a collaborative type of person. And because this is all behavioral and we want to push people in the right direction and get them to change their behavior and do what's right for them, I realized a psychologist would be an ideal partner. And that's how I started reaching out to psychologists, and I got very lucky to find Laura, and she was at the right place, and it was a perfect mix of talents and personality, and that's how this book came about.
We're going to get back to the subject at hand, but given the fact that you're the money guy, and most of us are quite irrational when it comes to our money, how fine of a line do you tread when you're dealing with clients?
That's a good question. We're obviously going to do the logical stuff and we'll do the numbers and we'll make sure everyone's okay and we'll make sure everyone's invested the way they should be invested. But sometimes people are afraid. So, for instance, there was someone I was working with who was very young, but she was very conservative and she didn't like losing money. And I had to show her that, look, if you don't take risks now at your age, your risk is running out of money when you retire. So you need to take care of that fear that you have and go for it because otherwise you're not going to live the retirement that you want to live. So that's just one example. There's some people I work with, there's another couple I work with, they're extremely aggressive and they're nearing retirement and they have a lot of money and they don't need to be aggressive. In fact, they run the risk of losing money and wrecking their retirement if they go more conservative. They will never run out of money. And if they continue to be highly risky, they have the chance of running out of money, right? So this is how we're irrational. And how I deal with that is it's really hard to deal with that because people are not fully rational. But I show them the numbers, I show how things would work out. And then the other thing I do is I try to make people aware of our biases as human beings, of our irrationalities. And I point out what humans do. And often people will say, oh, yeah, okay, I kind of see that behavior in myself. I understand that. And okay, we'll go the rational, logical route because I now understand the biases I'm bringing to the table and I'll do my best to overcome them.
Okay, I'm going to just write myself a note to message my financial planner and tell her to send me a thank you note. Because,
I love
30 years ago, it was like the high side of moderate risk. I won't say high risk. I don't think I'd ever go there. But now, as I'm older, it's like, nah, we're bringing that risk factor down quite a bit. So there we go. Okay. All right. You have a division of time. You describe three phases of retirement. And I love this, the go-go years, the slow-go years. I had go-go boots. I'm that old. The go-go years, the slow-go years, and the no-go years. So, what do people do now to extend the go-go years? Sorry, I have to dance every time I say that, and avoid premature decline.
That all comes down to taking care of yourself. And the three main components of that are proper sleep, proper nutrition, and exercise. If you take care of your body, you're going to have a longer period of go-go years. You're going to get to enjoy your retirement, enjoy your boomer years, because those are the three magic things to keep the decline from happening.
And it is that simple. I might add a fourth thing in there now is stress control and reduction, although that one I just laugh at. I can't say that with a straight face, just being a working parent and just trying to do balance everything. I think there's no way to not have stress, but yeah, that's exactly the recipe. You keep yourself healthy. The earlier you start, the better the outcome. But it's never too late to start. I think that's the most important message is even if you are well into retirement, and I'll put the little air quotes up too, you can still start tomorrow. But everybody who starts tomorrow, a year from now, will be able to say, I started a year ago. So it's still, there's always a benefit, even for people who are lifelong smokers. I mean, I'll tell my students this. You can smoke for 40 years if you quit tomorrow. A year from now, you're going to be healthier than if you don't quit. And 10 years from now, you can erase most of the damage. So it's possible to regain health and get on top of things. And every step we can take gets us closer to having longer go-go years.
So it's like I got you both dancing
I'm
now.
dancing too now.
So it's like that old proverb that the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is today.
Now, you got it. You got it.
All right. It's interesting talking to two people because the time just flies. Now, before we get to the workbook, have we covered the six essentials beyond our nest egg? Have we missed anything?
I've got a little cheat sheet here. We
Good.
talked about happiness. We talked about purpose a little bit. We touched on purpose. I don't know if we talked really about values, and that's something that we really emphasize is that if you know what your values are and you live your life based on your values, that's going to give you purpose and that's going to make your life more rewarding. So I think we could probably touch on that. We talked about, oh, and the other thing we really didn't talk about is
The living
environment.
environment.
Like where you're going to live, what the climate is, what are the amenities where you live, if you want to stay in your home and age in place, or if you're going to relocate, if you are going to age in place, do you have a two-story home or do you have a one-story home? Do you have the right door handles on your doors? Those kinds of things. So I think those are the things we didn't touch on.
Okay, I just want to say that at some point, like I'm in the process of rebranding a bunch of things I've done in the past. And you're making me feel really good because I have got some of those questionnaires. Where do you want to live? You know, blah, 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 all those little things. So this is great. Do not think that I came to this episode and then just went and cheated off all your stuff. Okay, so who wants to start then with, was it environment and
Yeah, no, I think
And values.
that's what we focus on by developing a workbook was we didn't want just a, read this and think about it. We wanted to read this, think about it, and do something about it. And we wanted it to be step by step. So there are literal worksheets in there that lead the reader through step by step. First, think about these things. Now that you've got this, go through and circle this and cross this out. And it's really leading people through an easy process. If I just ask you cold, what are your values? You probably come up with a couple, but will they be, fine-tuned? We try to walk through a process that allows you to fine-tune without all the, mental math. And so that's kind of how we lead people to think about values. And then throughout the rest of the workbook, it's remember those values that we determined were important for you. How do they apply here? Are you being true to your values when you make these other decisions? And I think at the end of the day, the ultimate goal is for someone like me or you to be able to walk into Aaron or any financial planner and say, I've done some homework. I'm here to help you do your job to help me do this as successfully as possible. And so that was the whole onus. It's really just, can we create a tool that is user-friendly, that gets the user there in a fun and easy way, and then allows the back-end user, the financial planner, to have something tangible to help individuals make these decisions.
And we think that the values component is so important because if you're living your life according to your values and cutting out the things, we only have a finite amount of bandwidth, right? We can't do everything. Some people who are no longer working full time, maybe they think, well, now I've got all this time. What am I going to do? Right? But by having your values guide what you do, guide your activities, guide your day, create purpose for you. So that you can live a meaningful life. That's where it's all at, right? You're not spending your time in front of the TV day and night because you have something to do and a reason to do it. Unless watching TV is a high value for you, then maybe you do that.
Well, I recently interviewed someone who said statistics show that people, I don't know, between like age 65 and 74, and this is in the States, but I think it sort of goes for the entire Western world, they watch like 4.3 hours of TV a day. So if you want to do something, I just heard somebody, it was a very successful author, interviewed on talk radio the other day, and he was said, like, how should people pursue their dream? He said, put down the phone, turn off the TV. So when you think about 30 hours a week available to you to do something productive or valuable, to just play on that word, yeah, pretty crazy.
You're right. And that doesn't even include the time on the internet and scrolling, you know, the doom
Yeah.
scrolling that we do and the mindless just going through all of the things on the web. I mean, add those two together and you can easily come up with more than 40 hours a week of free time.
And if you have a clear idea of what your values are and a clear purpose of what you want to do, you wake up every day excited with a list of things you really want to get done, and you're not going to waste your time 4.5 hours on TV or doom scrolling through the internet because you have things to do. You have a purpose, you have a reason to spend your day in a productive way.
Is it also safe to say that, you know, with your workbook and your worksheets is, you know, if somebody says, nope, I'm going to stay in my home, I raise my children here, blah, 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 blah. And then year and a half up the road, they have an accident, they break their hip, and they say, I got to sell because I need a bungalow. That, you know, nothing's written in stone, shall we say, except your values.
So true. So true, Agnes. I'm a certified financial planner. I tell people I don't like doing financial plans. I like doing financial planning because life always changes. And the second the ink is dry on a financial plan, it's outdated the next day because things change. Life changes all the time. So having a plan in place is important, but being able to adjust along the way as life throws curveballs at you is really important too.
And that's why by getting people to focus on what their underlying values are, where the important relationships are, what the important meaning and purpose is in life, that helps to keep the focus so that when all plans go awry, as they eventually do, there's still, we still have the compass pointing north. We still know what direction we want to head in. So once we've got those things established, the planning can stay on top of that.
Right. Now, this podcast is called the Boomer Woman's Podcast. We're talking retirement. Air quotes. Now, is there an age group younger than us who should actually be doing this to get the most financial planning benefit?
The planning should start as soon as possible. It's, you know, plant that tree today if you haven't planted it 20 years ago. What the book, the planning with the book, again, life changes. And I think perhaps the best time to start with this book, if you're in that age, would be, I think once you've pretty much, if you have kids, being an empty nester, that's kind of the next big thing after raising the kids and the kids moving out. The next big thing in life is retirement. That's the time you start thinking about these kinds of things. Where do you want to live? What kind of life do you want to have? These are really important questions once the kids are out of the house, or if you're nearing retirement, in quotes, if you're nearing the end of your career and you're looking for the next big thing. I think that's where this book really fits in well. And then if you're recently no longer working full time, this is really good too, because it helps you set up your compass pointing north, as Laura said, so that you know what you're going to do, so that you can create that purpose and that meaning in your life and really enjoy those years in your next stage.
I think for us boomers, we've considered a number of the things that are in your workbook. Have any of your clients who are younger, they're empty nesters perhaps, said, "Holy crap, I never even thought about that." Is there any part of that that
Oh yeah, plenty of people don't think of this.
okay.
They and you know, many people haven't really thought much about it at all. When you're busy with your career and trying to make ends meet, and possibly if you're raising a family and just all the chaos that goes with that, there's just no time to think about any of this. And I think that once you get to, you know, that emptiness area of life, then that's when you really start thinking about these things. And again, I'm a planner. I love planning, and but I do recommend that people actually start trying to figure this stuff out when they're thinking about it, because you only get to do retirements once. You only get the second chance in life once, and you might as well use, you've worked your whole life to get there. You might as well enjoy it to the fullest. So figure it out ahead of time so that when you get there, you maximize it.
Right.
I used to work in the movie business, and we would take multiple takes of scenes, and actors would mess up a line or whatever. Do it again till it's just right. Well, we don't get a second chance. We don't get a second take in life. So plan it out, figure it out now so that you can make it the best you can possibly make it.
And Agnes, for your listeners, I think this is one of the things I've noticed studying aging and gerontology for the last couple of decades. Is the boomers are really unique, particularly the women in this generation. For women prior to the boomer generation, retirement was not a thing a woman did. It was something that her husband did, and she kind of went along for the ride. Women were not considered in the retirement equation. It was a conversation between, a man and the financial planner and, the conversation might include, like, what do I leave my wife? With the boomer generation, this was the first generation of women that we really saw at, in large numbers who were in the workforce, who took control of their own finances, who maybe, survived widowhood, divorce, in charge of themselves and their own money. And I think it's really exciting for me to see the boomers setting the stage for the next generation of young women who I think get to see their mothers and eventually their grandmothers be able to demonstrate that women can take control of their finances, that women can be in charge of all their decisions and how they want to spend their entire lives, and not have to have it be dictated. And so this is something that is really exciting to me. To be able to reach this audience in particular, because this is our time, right? We get to make these decisions and we get to be in full control. And you don't need a spouse or partner to have a rewarding retirement and to be able to do this on our own terms. And this is where values come into play. And as Aaron has stated, it does, you don't have to be wealthy to have a rewarding retirement. Have enough to make your ends meet, and then the rest of it you get to do with what you want.
I love how you talk about the next generation. One of the other things that I say quite a bit is that I am now too old to change the world, but I'm quite happy to be a role model for the next generation of women who will change the world.
Yes, I love that so much. And that is, Erickson would call that generativity. That's what we do in this life stage, and it is so powerful. So to be able to be that role model for young women, it's finding the 18 and 20 somethings in your life who, and saying you might only be able to invest $10 every week of that paycheck, but do it, and here's why. And really helping young women in particular understand that they can start now by taking control.
Is there anything we haven't talked about that you want mid-age women to think about after listening to this conversation?
We could go into the, if you have a partner, how the dynamics are when one or both partners are working, it's a very different dynamic than when they're both at home, and how it's really important if you do have a partner to have separate lives still, separate interests, separate activities for yourself, but then also activities together.
I'm often reminded of this is many years ago when my children were in elementary school. One of their friends had a neighbor who was in that situation where he was newly retired. She had been a stay-at-home homemaker her entire life, and he would follow her about. And I guess she put up with this for a very short amount of time. And then she would get up like she had done for the last 40 years, make him a lunch, walk up to the door, kiss him on the cheek, and say, "Don't come back till 5 o'clock."
And that story is well documented. Well documented. In fact, one of my closest childhood friends, her mom had been a homemaker for 40 plus years, and probably 3 weeks, it wasn't that long after her husband retired, after being out of the house, she went and got her first job of her life. Minimum wage, working at the library, but she was like, I can't be. He's in my space. He's everywhere all the time. And I think it really requires some very clear communication about what the new norms are going to be. And that I think that would be the piece of advice I would counsel anybody on. If you are changing your dynamic in any way, there needs to be conversation, maybe some ground rules, some expectations, and keeping that open door of communication, because things are going to come up you haven't even thought about. But, you know, he's here for lunch, and I used to just, this is what I did for lunch, and now he's messing it up. What is that going to look like? How do we navigate what is a very new dynamic in the household?
And in fairness to the gentleman that's with us today, I will say that I don't think it's going to be many generations until the other side of that coin will be happening. You know, because I do know people that say, you know, no, she's got better earning potential than me, so I'm going to be a stay-at-home homemaker as a man. So yeah, it'll be interesting if the pendulum swings, or if they work it out somehow, given our example.
Right.
You got it.
Okay.
So it's important just to have your own thing, but also have things together. And it's important to work that out. And we actually have a space in the workbook where couples can, if you have a partner, for each of you to fill out your own worksheets, but then come together and then try and compare and contrast and see where the values line up, see where the activities line up, and then really plan that second phase of your life with your partner. And there's other con relationship considerations too. You know, dynamics change with adult children. Some boomers still have elderly parents that they have to take care of, and those dynamics are really different too. Your parents raised you, you were always their kid, they always took care of you, and if you have elderly parents who are sick, you know, how are you going to take care of them? And what kind of conversations do you need to have with them so that they feel comfortable with you taking over the reins? You went through this, Agnes, with your mom. Was it a challenge for you to get her to share her financial situation or relinquish some independence so that you can take care of her?
My mother had dementia, and with her dementia came nastiness. So anytime we're out in public, she would tell them that I was her jailer, I was stealing her money, that
Right.
sort of thing. So fortunately, most of the places that we ever went together were people that knew me, because I didn't want the
Right.
police on the doorstep.
Right.
But you know, I mean,
And
and
that's
every
also where
go ahead.
I mean, that's also where the planning comes in with family, right? Do you want to plan ahead of time to make sure you know where the estate planning documents are, to make sure that you have power of attorney so that you can do the financials for your parents if they're elderly, if they're still around? With kids, do you have the right relationship? Are they expecting you to help them with grandchildren? Or is it kind of a just a, you can kind of come in and spoil them, or are they really relying on you? How far away are you going to live from extended family? Are you going to live somewhere on your own far away, or are you going to live near them? You know, I like in the book, I think we ask, do you want to walk to visit family and friends, drive to visit family and friends, or fly to visit family and friends?
Yeah, one thing that I make clear when I do interview other people who discuss this whole thing is I live, I don't know, a 10-minute drive, 20-minute drive from my grandchildren. They range in age from 3 to 15. They are all so busy that if I was here only to be part of their lives, I'd be crushed, because I have to make an appointment to see them. They're that busy, you know? And I mean, yay, that's the way it should be. But, you know, it can be an eye opener if you're going to move across the country so you can be near your grandchildren. That's a whole nother conversation. We can go down all sorts of rabbit holes here. Where do we find you on the World Wide Web?
You can find the book website at retire. You can find the book's website at retiring. Oh my God, I did this before.
it.
You can find the book website, which is retiring.
You know,
Okay.
and
You can
I'm
find the
after
book.
my intro,
Rewarding
I'm going to
retirement
leave
work
this
quick.
all in.
Here we go. Here we go. You ready? You
Do
ready?
you want me to say it? Rewarding
No, I'm kidding. I got
retirement
it. I got it.
workbook. Report at, re repeat after me.
Our website is the rewardingretirementworkbook.com, and the book is available on Amazon.
Well done.
Okay.
That's a tongue
Now,
twister.
oh dear. So, okay, I usually ask people a more personal question at the end. Aaron, you've already partly gone there. First of all, I ask permission. May I ask you a slightly more personal question before we close?
Sure.
Laura's living in fear right at
I
the moment. Now, Aaron, you were the original impetus for this project. How did you find Laura and why Laura? See, you started on that a little while ago, but.
I just did a bunch of emails. I just started looking up professors of psychology, and I started sending out messages. And Laura was particularly an exceptional find because not only is she a psychologist, but she's also someone who is an expert in aging studies. So I got very fortunate that she reached out to me. And although we are not physically far away, we're also not physically close. I'm in Los Angeles County. She's in Orange County in California, which is it's only about 40, 50 miles, but that could be anywhere from 2 to 3 hours
Have
with traffic.
technology now.
We have technology. And speaking of technology, the fascinating thing is we pretty much wrote this book during COVID, and we never actually met until about, how long was it, Laura? About 3 years after this
Yeah,
project
probably.
began that we finally met in person.
Yeah. Holy moly. And now, Laura, what enticed you to say yes to the collaboration? I think after spending a couple of decades in academia where, I'm a researcher, not a practitioner as a psychologist. And so I spend all this time doing this research and you publish stuff and it goes out into the world and you just kind of wonder what happens to it after that, right? And I've also kind of really made it sort of my life's mission in sort of the second phase of my career to what my colleagues and I call gerontologizing as many people as possible. So to get all of these other fields to recognize that they should really integrate working with older adults into their fields as well. And so when a certified financial planner comes knocking at the door and is like, I'm interested in gerontologizing my field, it was almost like this unicorn of like, really, there's a professional who provides a meaningful service who wants to know about this research and actually incorporate it to make services better. And so for me, it was a very easy sell. And then Aaron is just so lovely to work with and just easy to get along with. It was a no-brainer to just be like, this is the opportunity to get that research out into the world in a meaningful way.
That's interesting you say that because I've talked to a couple of financial planners who retired and then went, oh my God, it was a case of physician heal thyself. And then they got into the business that Aaron's currently in of saying, well, I'm sure they're saying, don't do what I did. They're saying, you got to be prepared this way and that way. So. Okay, the website link, and I'll get it right, I promise, is to the workbook is in the show notes. Any links, other links that you want included, will be on your page at our website. Listeners, if you have thoughts on today's show, please talk to us. The creative partnership between a gerontologist and a financial planner is unique, as far as I know, in the world of retirement planning. It's brought us an interesting view. I'm curious what you think. Leave comments where you're listening, or if you're listening at boomwithabang.com, scroll to the bottom of the page and talk to us there. What question did I not ask these two people? Ask it in the comments and I'll get you an answer. Share this episode. Together, Laura and Aaron have raised issues and possibilities that we may not have considered. After you send this conversation to a friend, you may have a lot of fun discussing possibilities and filling out their workbook. If you enjoyed this conversation, click the follow button at your favorite podcast platform. It helps us grow. I'm also registered at Substack. Following there is free, and you'll get notified every time an episode is released. Have you checked out the resource tab at Boom with a Bang yet? You can look up previous podcast episodes by subject. You can find books written by guests, including today's workbook, some interesting courses and offerings, lists of age-appropriate job and philanthropic possibilities. And if you're at all curious about the life of a house slash pet sitter, I'm journaling that journey on the website too. Erin Kirsch, Laura Zettel Watson, thank you for being my guests today and giving us a lot of food for thought about the potential of our post 9 to 5. Interesting seeing, you've come together like a lot of collaborations do, but it's still interesting seeing the different lens that you bring to the subject. So thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Thank you so
Our
much.
pleasure.
Have a great rest of the week.